Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Jay. On the same day that Donald Trump was elected as the next president of the United States of America, news has emerged that Cuba has launched a five-day period of nationwide military exercises. Given Trump's various noises about reversing the recent thaw in U.S.-Cuban relations, we'll be asking if the timing is more than coincidental.
Could Donald Trump's victory boost the chances of French far-right politician Marine Le Pen? We get the views of Professor of French Politics James Shields.
Organisations campaigning against the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership have found themselves an unexpected new ally in the election of Donald Trump. But will the president-elect, who has spoken out against TTIP and the similar NAFTA and TTP trade deals, act on his pre-election promises?
Almost one-fifth of all Americans now live in states which have legalised marijuana. But could this mark a real cultural shift for the nation, which currently arrests one person every 25 seconds for drug possession and which launched the so-called War on Drugs 45 years ago?
As human rights groups raise concerns over the plight of refugees spending the winter months in tented villages across Europe, authorities in Paris have welcomed refugees to the city's first official humanitarian refugee camp.
Trump emerged as the clear winner of the US presidential election this week, the choice of a majority of American voters, except, well, he wasn't. We'll be looking at new polling suggesting that Americans aren't happy with a system that can see someone lose the popular vote and enter the White House nonetheless.
And could the world soon have a brand new nation? What are the chances for the nation of cow?
All that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus.
On the same day that Donald Trump was elected as the next president of the United States of America, news has emerged that Cuba has launched a five-day period of nationwide military exercises, prompting a great deal of speculation as to whether the two events are related.
The relationship between the island nation of Cuba and its northern neighbour has only recently begun to thaw after decades of hostilities dating back to the Cuban Revolution and subsequently the Cold War. But a Trump presidency always posed a threat to that process of normalised relations, ever since he announced during his campaign an intention to undo Barack Obama's ongoing dialogues with the Castro administration in Havana.
We're also going to stand with the Cuban people in their fight against communist oppression. Now we're on the right side. The president's one-sided deal for Cuba and with Cuba benefits only the Castro regime. But all of the concessions that Barack Obama has granted the Castro regime were done through executive order, which means the next president can reverse them. And that I will do unless the Castro regime meets our demands. Not my demands, our demands. You know what the demands are.
Donald Trump speaking earlier this year whilst he was still campaigning for the US presidency.
Cuba will spend 5 days now conducting its Bastion strategic exercise drills to prepare troops for what it calls, quote, a range of enemy actions. Historically, these exercises have been conducted during times of high tension with the United States. Indeed, the first such occasion coincided with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1981. The launch of the drills was announced on Wednesday on the front page of the country's main newspaper, Granma, stating that the exercises will begin November 16th, warning that there would be, quote, movements of troops and war material, overflights and explosions in the cases where they're required.
Many Cubans have expressed concerns that Trump will stop the boom in business and tourism that they have experienced since the opening up of relations with Washington. Others in the nation were rooting for Trump because they believe that Cuba jumped into the new relationship with the United States too quickly.
Earlier today, I spoke with Dr. Par Kumaraswamy, an associate professor in Latin American Cultural Studies at the University of Reading, and I began by asking her whether the timing of this announcement was a coincidence.
It's more than a coincidence. It is actually quite a strategic move on the part of the Cuban government to make it quite clear as a sort of a gesture, a warning shot, that although the change of president has occurred and there is nothing that can be done to reverse that, Cuba is aware of what that might mean for its Austin Island and for its continued survival as a government and as a revolutionary process that's underway. So it's a warning shot across the bow. Last time that happened was when Ronald Reagan came to the White House, and that was obviously in the midst of the Cold War, so it is sending out a message that although the Cold War has changed quite a bit, or the nature of the Cold War has changed quite a bit, some of the same tensions and some of the same assumptions are still there. So it is more than anything else a warning shot.
Do you think it's likely to influence the new administration in Washington's view of Cuba?
That's a very difficult question. I'm not sure that Donald Trump is particularly clear about what he would like to do about Cuba. What I do know is that a large part of his support came from the Cuban-American community or sectors of the Cuban-American community in Florida, who have always traditionally supported the Republicans because of their stance on Cuba and specifically the blockade. And so I think in terms of a clear policy from the U.S., it's too early to say what Donald Trump and his administration might think about what they're going to do about Cuba. But it certainly is a new era, especially after the last couple of years of opening up and the relaxing of the relations between Cuba and the U.S. under Obama as president.
I wonder, it's probably accurate to say that Cuban opinion on the recent change in relationship with the U.S. has been divided. There's many that have welcomed the boom in tourism and so on. But there seems to be a chunk of opinion that would almost rather a continuation of confrontation or even a return to a more hostile relationship with the U.S. I wonder if that's to do with just a legacy of having become used to that status quo over half of a century, or is it a fear of a change in the ideologies of the Cuban Revolution, or indeed what it means to be Cuban?
You're absolutely right. It's a very, very complex question, and there are very complex and very diverse perspectives amongst the Cuban population, but also amongst the political leaders. Let's not forget that this is over 50 years of a revolution which has encompassed several generations, each of which have had slightly different understandings of what the revolution means or doesn't mean to them, and each of whom have approached the revolution in different ways. What the Raúl Castro administration has been attempting to do is to try and meet the needs of all of those different generations, to send out messages that, yes, we are open to the thawing of relations, and they've certainly done that in their welcoming of Obama and in the re-founding of the U.S. Embassy in Havana. But there is what is known as the historic generation. These are the people that actually fought in the insurrection and in the revolution. Many of them died in recent years, but many of them are still alive, and that includes Fidel Castro and Raúl Castro. And it is an attempt to try and reconcile their views, reconcile their perspectives with those of the younger generation who, as you say, are looking for change specifically, not really ideologically, but change in terms of their economic circumstances, their lifestyle, their material needs, housing, access to food, etc., etc. So it's a very complicated question. What the main point, I think, that unites all Cubans of whatever generation and whatever perspective on the revolution is that there has been a lot of talk about relaxation of relations and opening up of an economic relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, but what is not gone is the economic embargo. And that's something that Cubans of all hues and of all generations are very clear about. Until there is a clear policy on what will happen with the blockade that is really, let's say, it's guided the development of Cuba in rather negative ways, there is no real change for the people of Cuba. So tourism is very welcome. Economic reform, which has been implemented by the Cuban government itself, is very welcome for many people. But there are still a lot of very, very difficult unanswered questions.
Dr. Par Kumaraswamy, Associate Professor in Latin American Cultural Studies at the University of Reading, speaking to me earlier today. With me on the line now from Nottingham is Professor Anthony Capcha from the Centre for Research on Cuba at the University of Nottingham. Thank you for coming on the programme, Professor Capcha. Now, when we talk about these planned military manoeuvres, what exactly are we looking at? Is this something that's confined to the Cuban military, or is this something that affects the whole island?
Well, it's actually both, in as much as everybody in Cuba, all males, are normally required to do military service, and many of them are kept on or keep themselves on in the reserve afterwards. So between them, the military and their various branches can actually call on quite a large number of Cubans. And that includes civil defense. It includes also the neighborhood, the street level committees for defense of the revolution. So the most of these maneuvers are not localized. They are pretty widespread indeed. And it's more a case of military preparedness than anything else, rather than going around shooting guns and firing rockets.
So they're kind of defensive exercises.
Indeed. And it has certainly been going on since the start of the revolution in the light of obvious threats, real threats early on, and then rhetorical threats, potential threats much later. So every time the United States ratchets up the pressure on Cuba in one way or another, those exercises become more visible.
Relations between Cuba and the US are obviously, whilst they've become softened lately, they're still incredibly difficult and complicated. Do you think that the work towards normalizing relations by Obama is likely to continue in some form, or will it be entirely undone in the early days of Trump's presidency?
Actually, your guess is as good as mine, because no one quite knows how much of the rhetoric, the electoral rhetoric, will actually turn into politics. We all hope not much of it, one way or another. The fact is, I think that Obama's hands were tied, and they were tied by his inability to persuade Congress that the embargo should be ended. That inability, it would have increased no end. So obviously the defeat of the Democrats and a continuing Republican-dominated Congress in both houses really means the chances of any end to the embargo continue to be put off and put off. My guess is nothing will happen on that actually till 2021. There are specific reasons for that. And you're right, that is what complicates those improvements, because the improvements have been mood music. They've been the reduction in the obvious hostility. But as long as the embargo's there, and it still clearly works, it's still clearly, well, effective in making life difficult in Cuba, then as long as that's there, the Cubans have continued to consider the United States still in something of a state of war with the Cuban system.
Obviously, Donald Trump gave himself a certain amount of breathing room when he said that he wanted to reverse Obama's moves on Cuba. He said that he wanted to improve relations with Cuba, but he wanted to do it the right way. He wanted to do it democratically. He wanted to do it according to his demands, etc., etc. But, I mean, for all that Trump may dislike the administration in Havana, he has built his image very much on a position of anti-interventionism. And with that in mind, one might assume that the worst that Cuba had to fear would just be a return to relations as they were just 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, I would guess, actually, that that is likely, that that is probably what's going to happen. Because in a sense, what Bush did before was reverse the few moves, but steady moves, that the Clinton administration had made over the previous 8 years. And what Obama did was reverse. So in a sense, up until that declaration of improved relations and then the signing of the improved relations, Obama had done little more than restore what the Clinton administration put into effect. And the guess is that he would go back to the Bush world. But one of the aspects of that is interesting, because when Bush restricted remittances going to Cuba, the very people who'd supported him in Florida, for example, the Cuban Americans, protested enormously because they wanted their families to get those remittances. Hmm. And so Trump's promise to cut back remittances, I suspect, may not be acted on because he needed those votes.
Anthony Kapcher, thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon.
You're more than welcome.
As we discussed on the show yesterday, the global implications of Donald Trump's victory as President of the United States are far-reaching and highly varied. While for now we can only speculate over what may occur over the next 4 years, there are some nations which may feel the impact much sooner, especially those nations with upcoming elections and a growing anti-establishment right-wing movement of their own. Leo Mohair has more on what it could mean for events in France.
Could Donald Trump's victory boost the chances of Marine Le Pen causing an upset in France? The French election is set to take place in the spring of next year, and France's far-right leader is expected to do increasingly well. Like Trump, she's populist, nationalist, an outsider, and bills herself as anti-establishment. Few people now doubt that she will reach the second round of the presidential runoff. I asked James Shields, Professor of French Politics, just how similar Le Pen is to Donald Trump.
Well, it's no surprise that Marine Le Pen was one of the first to congratulate Donald Trump on his victory. They play to the same anti-establishment, alienated audience. They share the same xenophobic, anti-immigration and anti-Islam positions, with the association between Islam and terrorism in particular being central to their vision. They're both charismatic individuals, and they exploit the same conditions: economic crisis, globalization, unemployment, low wages for many workers, the squeeze on middle-class wealth, and importantly, a widespread feeling of disaffection from the established political class, alienation from the established political elites. So there's a lot of common ground between Trump and Le Pen.
I think if you'd said to most people in the beginning of this year that you were going to see Brexit in June, a Trump election in November, they wouldn't have believed you. But is it possible that we could now see Marine Le Pen victory in France next year? Is that on the cards?
Many polls have predicted that Marine Le Pen will do well enough to contest the runoff next April, May. In fact, that's a consensus across pretty much all the polling, that she will be one of the two finalists. And the very odd poll has suggested that she might just beat the incumbent, President François Hollande, if he were to be her opponent there. But he's not at all likely to make it to the runoff. And no poll has given Marine Le Pen a chance of beating her likely centre-right opponent, Alain Juppé or Nicolas Sarkozy.
How much can we believe polls these days, though, after the election in America?
That's a very good question. And you'd have to qualify any belief that you set by polls. But there's, if you like, there's harder statistical evidence against Marine Le Pen winning the presidential election next year. And what I mean by that is that winning a presidential runoff is all about building a grand coalition, attracting the second preference votes of candidates eliminated on the first round. And if we look back, say, to 2012, François Hollande there grew his support from 10 million in the first round to 18 million in the runoff, and Nicolas Sarkozy from just under 10 million to 17 million in the runoff. Now, there's no evidence at all that Marine Le Pen could rally that sort of support. All the evidence is to the contrary. Since the FN is a party without any allies in the political system in France, so she has no place to go for substantial support beyond her own base. And the one precedent we have for a Le Pen making the presidential runoff was Marine's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, in 2002. There, he barely managed to add anything to his first round vote, a few hundred thousand, while his opponent, Jacques Chirac, added 20 million to his to win the runoff by 82% to 18%. Now, it has to be said that Marine Le Pen is a much more formidable electoral proposition than her dad. But the auguries for 2017 are still not good for her. Though, as we've said, in the current climate of major political shocks and upsets, you might think twice about putting the house on it. And you certainly wouldn't put the house on her failing to make future presidential challenges in 2022 or 2027, maybe with a stronger prospect then of success.
And as much as Marine Le Pen welcomed the election of Donald Trump, how much concern do you think there is in the French establishment by Hollande and even in the wider European Union that some of the very values that they hold dear to either to the French Republic or to the European Union itself could now be under threat?
I think there's a great deal of nervousness and anticipation of what's going to come next. And let's remember, of course, that the only thing we have to go on up to this point is Donald Trump's rhetoric. We've got no clear policy program. So leaders around Europe need to wait and see what he actually does before knowing, you know, whether the short-term boost, for example, that his election has given to populist movements across Europe is going to be sustained. It has to be said that it's much easier to be a populist outsider than a populist insider. And Trump has now entered the system. He now is the system. And the anti-system support base that put him in the White House may, in due course, turn their anger on him. So I think we're watching now to see what the next step is, what he actually does as policy, and then I think the judgments will follow as to what sort of president he's going to be and what the implications for that follow are for European leaders.
Very interesting to get your thoughts, James, and hopefully we'll talk to you as well more in the lead up to the French election next year. Thanks very much for joining us.
Always.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, organisations campaigning against the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership have found themselves an unexpected new ally in the shape of Donald Trump. But will the president-elect, who has spoken out against TTIP and the similar NAFTA and TTP trade deals, act on his pre-election promises?
Almost one-fifth of all Americans now live in states which have legalized marijuana, but could this mark a real cultural shift for the nation which currently arrests one person every 25 seconds for drug possession and which launched the so-called war on drugs 45 years ago?
The UK Home Office has been refused planning permission to build a rapid removal centre for asylum seekers near Glasgow Airport. The decision puts the future of immigration detention in Scotland in question.
And could the world soon have a brand new nation? Just what are the chances for the nation of cow? European officials in Brussels are desperately fighting to keep alive hopes of the controversial Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, the EU-US trade deal being agreed, in the face of opposition to the dying deal from the newly elected US President Donald Trump.
President-elect Trump has made clear that he is passionately opposed to free trade agreements, which in his opinion work against US citizens by opening up home markets to foreign workers and non-tariff trading. He is opposed to the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, between the US, Canada and Mexico, because he blames it for a loss of the US manufacturing industry. He's pledged to hinder both the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Deal, TPP, a broad agreement that included Mexico, Brunei, Chile, New Zealand, Singapore, Australia, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, Peru, the United States and Vietnam, as well as TTIP.
Donald Trump made a lot of promises throughout his campaign, but whether or not he could or would actually ban TTIP is still up in the air. Speaking to Sputnik reporters earlier today, Dr. Reinhardt at the University of Essex's Department of Governance said that Trump was more likely to focus on enforcing tariffs and said he would be unable to unilaterally repeal NAFTA. She added, quote, "It's up to Congress to ratify TTIP and to approve it. If Congress ratifies it, then he would have to veto it. And if he exercises his veto over and over again, it's going to start problems. It could mean that TTIP will fall apart." Jim Empson joins us on the line. Jim, you've been following this story closely. What's the reaction to Trump's election being among TTIP campaigners?
Well, those that are in favour of it, for instance, European Council President Donald Tusk and the Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker have both very, very quickly fired off a letter to President Trump, President-elect Trump, as I should call him, saying, really, we want to open negotiations with you as fast as possible to keep TTIP going. While opponents, as perhaps we'll talk about in a few moments, have said this is the death throes of the TTIP trade agreement. You've got to understand that despite being a capitalist at heart and a multi-billionaire and a wheeler and dealer, Trump has made a major part of his campaign the fact that the various trade deals that they've done, not least of all the North American Free Trade Alliance, NAFTA, with Mexico and Canada, he blames that for the loss of manufacturing jobs. So he is anti any trade deal that, in his opinion, doesn't work for the US.
And that probably comes as quite a surprise to many that a billionaire businessman would be against what is a deal which would benefit billionaire corporations.
Well, exactly. But you've got to remember that with Trump, everything is me, me, me. Every deal he's always done is only done for him. You know, whenever people like Trump talk about win-win negotiations, it's a win for me and it's a win for me is the way they basically do it. So whilst, you know, it was a very populist approach, one has to say. So whilst you would not think he's against these trade deals, he is going to cause, I mean, he cannot technically speaking stop them because it's, of course, Congress that passes them in both houses. But he can do an awful lot to influence them. Mm-hmm. He really hates NAFTA. If he builds a wall, even if he tries to charge Mexico for it, if he builds a wall, the diplomatic and economic consequences of that are enormous. But certainly he's going to do something to stymie NAFTA. That, of course, is being replaced by the broader agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. But what's for sure is it's going to have serious knock-ons to TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is being a controversial deal being brokered between the EU and the US.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that those that oppose TTIP, perhaps for some slightly different reasons from Trump's opposition, a lot of the opposition to TTIP is from a very left-of-centre perspective. What have you been hearing from opponents who now have this new kind of unexpected ally?
Well, isn't it just extraordinary? The very people that you wouldn't expect to actually agree with Trump. I mean, for instance, UK-based, London-based War on Want, they've been going against it. Now, I spoke to them this morning. Mark Dern, who's their senior trade campaigner, told me, and I'll quote you this, Donald Trump's victory in the US presidential elections spelled bad news for TTIP, which was already in its death throes. EU leaders are well aware of this, as was made clear by a letter from the Council President Donald Tusk and President of the European Commission, which offers Trump, quote, sincere congratulations and a plea for an EU-US summit, quote, at his earliest convenience. That's what War on Want told me this morning. And what they're saying is, look, Trump is coming at this from a completely different angle to us. You know, we don't like his capitalism. We hate what he said about Muslims. We hate what he says, you know, his xenophobic, homophobic rhetoric. War on Want distances themselves from that. But they're saying we're on the same page on this particular one. So rather fascinating. What they're saying is, certainly the views that I'm getting, is that Tusk, Juncker and the Brussels bureaucrats are desperate to see if they can resurrect TTIP. Personally, with all the opposition, particularly in Germany, and growing opposition right the way throughout of Europe to the EU-US trade deal, I can't see this as anywhere near the top of Trump's agenda. And at the very, very least, this one's going to get kicked into the long grass.
Mm-hmm. Well, as with all elections, pre-election, vote-winning rhetoric doesn't always translate into policy. And Trump's made a lot of promises. So do you think perhaps that this might be one of those promises that maybe doesn't concentrate on too heavily?
He's got a problem because basically his own, whatever he tries to say, and this is a big one for him, you know, what his promise is about saying, I will quash these trade deals, I will put up barriers, I want everything best for the US. He's going to be under pressure from within the White House and the White House machine, the Pentagon and everyone else. He'll be under pressure to go ahead with these deals for various diplomatic reasons. The question is, will he hold out against them? Will they be able to de-brainwash the man, if that's not a rude enough expression? Will they be able to push him? I don't know. But maybe they will think, let's kick this one into the long grass and see what we can do in later times.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim Ensom, thank you very much.
Pot's been illegal in this country for almost 80 years. If Proposition 64 passes in November, so much in California is going to change.
That was a clip from an informative video produced by KPCC about California's Proposition 64, which did indeed get passed on Tuesday. That proposition means that marijuana will be legal for recreational use across California, and similar propositions were also passed in Maine, Massachusetts, and Nevada. When combined with states where marijuana is already legalized, regulated, and taxed, Alaska, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, nearly one-fifth of the population of America will soon be able to legally buy cannabis. But could this mark a cultural shift in the country that gave birth to the so-called war on drugs?
In June 1971, President Nixon declared the war on drugs, increasing the size and presence of federal drug control agencies and pushing through mandatory sentencing and no-knock warrants. At the time, he also temporarily recategorised cannabis as a Schedule 1 drug, the most restrictive category of drugs. The war on drugs, though, has come under attack over the decades, and for many years, human rights groups have been campaigning for major reforms to drug policies, claiming that the war on drugs has failed.
Just 2 weeks ago, Human Rights Watch released a report and short video entitled Every 25 Seconds, The Human Toll of Criminalizing Drug Use in the United States. The video highlights the incredibly high rates of imprisonment for drug possession and questions the appropriateness of the lengths of sentences.
Every 25 seconds, someone is arrested in the United States simply for possessing drugs for their personal use. Around the country, police make more arrests for drug possession than for any other crime. Over 1.25 million arrests per year.
Corey Ladd is a 27-year-old man that got sentenced to 20 years for half an ounce of weed. No parole, no probation, every single day in prison for 20 years for half an ounce a week.
Joining me on the line now is Danny Kushluk, Head of External Affairs for Transform, a charitable think tank that campaigns for the legal regulation of drugs both in the UK and internationally. Danny, 45 years after President Nixon announced the war on drugs, and it doesn't seem to have been that successful. Does the legalisation of marijuana, though, for recreational use, really mark the beginning of the end for the war on drugs?
At Transform, we would say that it is the beginning of the end, insofar as cannabis was always the shift that was likely to happen first in terms of a move from prohibition to regulation. And the model is the same. It's about government taking control of production and supply, enabling users to buy in a legitimate and regulated setting. And there's no reason why that shouldn't apply to other drugs. And the learnings that will accrue as a result of the legalization and regulation of cannabis will be applicable across all other drugs. They'll be in different settings. Heroin would only be available from a doctor, cocaine and ecstasy likely only available from a pharmacist. But the point is the same. Prohibition is a catastrophic failure all over the world, and government control and regulation is far better.
And the case for decriminalising drugs isn't based on the idea that all drugs are safe, is it?
Transform works on the basis that we need to put governments in control of production, trade and use of drugs precisely because they're dangerous. It's the same reason why people call for government to maintain control of alcohol and tobacco, why they want them to be in charge of boxing and rock climbing and the flying of helicopters and the driving of cars and indeed nuclear weapons and nuclear waste. The point here is that it's a no-brainer that governments control and regulate things better than gangsters and unregulated dealers.
We know that there are many arguments and concerns raised by those who are completely opposed to drug decriminalisation, but I imagine even you yourself must have some legitimate concerns over how decriminalisation would work and how that could be exploited. I'd be interested in knowing, if you do, what they are.
There's basically a spectrum of control that operates from a totally free market approach, which to a great extent we had with tobacco up until 10 or 20 years ago, and at various points in various places has been the case with alcohol. And then right the way through to the other end of the spectrum, which is ultra-prohibition, which is what President Duterte is currently running in the Philippines, where 3,500 people have been extrajudicially killed. Now, extremes are never good ways of doing things, and we would suggest that people move towards the middle of that spectrum, take the center ground, and put governments in very clear charge of production and supply, and make sure that corporates, to the extent that we can, are kept out of the business. So for us, the major concern we have is that governments fail to regulate strongly enough, and that industry, whether it be the pharmaceutical industry, the alcohol industry, the tobacco industry, or a newly emerging drug industry, is left unfettered by government control. But even in places where that may happen, the results of ending the prohibition and shifting to a system of government control, even if it were lax, would far exceed anything that we could possibly achieve by banging our heads against a brick wall and applying a regime that failed so obviously with alcohol prohibition in the US between 1920 and 1932.
The actual figures for imprisonments and incarcerations in America are incredibly high, and the sentences seem to be very long. For possession of cannabis, for example, can be years and years in prison. But recently a Human Rights Watch video also showed that there's a racial issue at play, that whilst drug use can be at similar levels in black and white communities, conviction rates of black people are far, far higher, sometimes 7 times higher, sometimes up to 11 times higher in Manhattan, for example. Is that an issue that is in place here as well in the UK? Do we see a kind of unfair targeting of specific ethnic minorities?
The situation between the US and the UK are remarkably similar. We have not only the same disproportionate arrest and conviction of black people, we have the same very low levels of well-being, and in both cases, societal well-being. And in both cases, both governments have attempted to deal with that lack of well-being and then throw into the mix institutionalized racism to really cause absolute misery and degradation, scapegoating, stigmatization and discrimination in our poorest communities, and particularly those where ethnic minority groups are, where their proportion is much higher. There is a scapegoating going on here, no doubt about it, that the UK is suffering not quite as badly as the US. But if you are black or Asian, you are much more likely to be stopped and searched, much more likely to be arrested, and much more likely to be convicted. And the drug laws provide a way, an outlet for that racism.
Just finally, to look a little bit at solutions that have come into effect, are there any case studies that show that solutions such as heroin prescription programs can actually reduce crime and reduce addiction rates?
The way to think about heroin prescribing, which people find difficult to get their heads around sometimes, is to think about it from the point of view of if it were your child who had a heroin problem. Now, would you want them to have to buy in the illegal market where they're buying dirty drugs, and particularly if they're a woman, to be involved in street sex work in order to get hold of the money, in order to pay the dealer? This is a recipe for enormous collateral damage that involves human beings who could be your daughter, your mother, your sister, your brother, your uncle, your cousin, your friend. At the very least, just a human being who lives near you. And these are people who need care and support. And the bottom line is that we shouldn't be forcing people who have problems of dependency into situations where they're buying in dangerous conditions and having to spend and find a lot of money in order to pay for an expensive habit. The bottom line is that there is an enormous amount of evidence, scientific evidence from all over the world, to show that heroin prescribing is cost effective, saves lives, increases people's health, reduces crime, reduces the public's access to heroin, because it's actually then controlled and regulated. The only way you can get it is by registering as a patient, not by just waving around a £20 or $20 note. So the best practice on this is shown to work all over the world, including the UK.
Well, Danny, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
The UK Home Office has been refused planning permission to build a rapid removal centre for asylum seekers near Glasgow Airport. The planning application was overwhelmingly rejected by Renfrewshire Council's planning board after almost 300 objections were lodged with the local council. Local politicians and campaigners had criticised plans for the new short-term facility to replace Dungavel Immigration Removal Centre in Lanarkshire, raising concerns that vulnerable asylum seekers risked being funnelled out of Scotland and away from family, friends and legal representation.
Well, for more of this, I'm now joined in the studio by Liam O'Hare. Liam, did this come as a surprise to you, this decision?
Well, it did. I think most people, even campaigners, expected this to get the green light. The planning application was made after the Home Office announced plans just in September to close down Dungavel, and that is the only immigration centre in Scotland. Now, that site's proved controversial in the past. In Scotland, some have described it as barbaric and even inhumane. And what happens next in Scotland, I think, is the thing that everyone is asking. We'll have to wait and see. The Home Office have contacted them today, but they've so far refused to confirm what next steps they intend to take. But there is growing pressure on detention, the policy of detention in the UK. Britain is the only country in the EU that does not have a time limit on detention, and a report commissioned by the Home Office themselves called on the country to drastically reduce the numbers of people detained. But indeed, others want the government to go even further, and campaigners are now asking for the policy of detention to be scrapped altogether.
You have actually made a film about Dungavel, haven't you, Liam? What did you learn from that?
That's right. Well, the film basically consists of interviews with detainees inside Dungavel, giving voice to people who are at the forefront of this, but whose voices are very rarely represented in the media. And there is a genuine desperation felt by the people that I spoke to. The majority are suffering from mental health issues, and suicide is also a big issue in detention centres. In the last year alone, there were over 390 suicide attempts, by people in detention centres in the UK. Now, that obviously averages at more than one a day. And that was not surprising from the conversations I had with people detained. And I think we can now listen to two detainees I spoke to, Iqbal and Hamdi.
First step, where I put my first step from plane, I said to them, many times I write it down to Home Office, look, I'm not animal, I'm not criminal. Just treat me like human. I was in 20 years in the UK. They keep me in detention center in Dangabel for 5 months. Already I had very big punishment. Please, if they send me back, I told them already, if they send me back Bangladesh or Pakistan or India, I will be killed myself.
If you want to detain someone, there should be a limited time, not like you have to detain someone like 3 months. They are not only destroying one person's life, they're destroying whole family, like, you know, the relationship, the love. The people I've seen over here, they are just broke down.
So as you can hear there, there's serious desperation felt by people inside detention. Now, campaigners have welcomed the prospect of Dungavel being closed in Scotland, but there are fears, as you heard, that people could be moved to another detention centre elsewhere in the UK, and this could actually lead to a worse situation for detainees, as they'll be away from family, away from the legal team, and really isolated even more so than they are just now. So the whole situation does remain very much up in the air.
And it is quite a complex situation for Scotland, because Scotland has a devolved government, obviously, but that devolved government doesn't get to make decisions about immigration controls. So whilst its councils can ban the creation of a detention centre, its government can't actually make any decisions on alternatives.
Absolutely. So you've got this sense of limbo, essentially, where the Scottish government is against the policy of detention, yet there is a detention centre still in Scotland, which is Dungavel, and there is very much a kind of wide consensus amongst all Scottish political parties, among civil society organisations, that detention is quite an inhumane policy and people don't really want it in Scotland. But as you say, ultimately the decisions on these issues are made at Westminster. Mm-hmm. In the white paper that the Scottish government released in the lead up to the independence referendum in 2014, they did make a commitment to shut down Dungavel. But obviously that was a no vote at that referendum. So the Scottish government, for all their statements against detention, for all the pressure they might put on the UK government, time will tell whether that's really going to have an impact.
Mm-hmm. They did have one major victory in they managed to forbid the detention of children in Dungavel, didn't they, in the last decade?
And that was a very serious campaign that led over 10 years ago. In actual fact, in one of the films that I made, I spoke to Pina Raksu, who was a detainee when she came over to the UK just as a child. Her and her younger sister were detained in Dungavel, and it was cases like that, like Pina's and like various other young people who are held in detention, that led to really an outcry from Scottish society about the conditions, and in particular, like you say, the detention of children. So that's one victory, at least, that campaigners have won.
Well, Liam O'Hare, thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Donald Trump emerged as the clear winner of the US presidential election this week, the choice of a majority of American voters, except he wasn't. And we'll be looking at new polling suggesting Americans aren't happy with a system that can see someone lose the popular vote and enter the White House nonetheless.
As human rights groups raise concerns over the plight of refugees spending the winter months in tented villages across Europe, authorities in Paris have welcomed refugees to the city's first official humanitarian refugee camp.
And could the world soon have a brand new nation? And could that brand new nation be the nation of cow?
Our responsibility as citizens is to keep doing our part to build that better, stronger, fairer America we seek. And I know you will. I want each of you to know that you were the best campaign anybody could have ever expected or wanted. You know, Scripture tells us, let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. So, my friends, let us have faith in each other. Let us not grow weary. Let us not lose heart. for there are more seasons to come and there is more work to do. I am incredibly honored and grateful to have had this chance to represent all of you in this consequential election. May God bless you and may God bless the United States of America.
The outgoing candidate for the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, giving her concession speech in New York yesterday following her defeat to Donald Trump in the US presidential election. There are still a couple more states to be officially called, but as it stands, the Republican Party's Donald Trump, now president-elect, is well ahead of Hillary Clinton in terms of electoral college votes, 279 to 228 as we go to air.
Which would naturally suggest that Donald Trump is the clear choice of the American people, right? Well, let's listen to an excerpt from Hillary's running mate Tim Kaine's concession speech delivered at the same event.
She has made history in a nation that is good at so many things, but that has made it uniquely difficult for a woman to be elected to federal office. She became the first major party nominee as a woman to be president and last night won the popular vote of Americans to be president. That is an amazing accomplishment. It is an amazing accomplishment.
The Democratic Party's nominee for vice president and Hillary Clinton's running mate, Tim Kaine, there, and that was a part of his concession speech yesterday.
Now, you probably noticed that he referred to the fact that Hillary had won the popular vote of Americans, and if you heard our programme on Tuesday, you'll be familiar with how that can be the case with a losing candidate. But if you didn't, you'd be forgiven for feeling a little bit confused. So, the US president is elected by the Electoral College, consisting of 538 electors. The number of electors each state has corresponds to the number of senators and congressmen and women from each state. To win, a presidential candidate must receive 270 electoral votes.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, it looks like there's a mood amongst many Americans to change that situation. According to a poll conducted by Sputnik this week, a majority of Americans, 60%, want to change the electoral system in the United States. Moreover, almost half of Americans, 45%, believe that they should change to a one-person, one-vote system. That survey was conducted by TNS UK for Sputnik News, and you can read more about that at sputniknews.com.
Now, it's only actually occurred five times in US history that a president has won without the popular vote. That includes this week, though. But for some time, there's been a movement in the United States for what's known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, or NPVIC. And earlier this week on World in Focus, I spoke with Drew Penrose, legal director at Fair Vote, which campaigns for electoral reform in the US. And he explained to me the arguments in favor of NPVIC.
First of all, the swing state, safe state dynamic would be completely gone under a national popular vote. Candidates, in order to win, would genuinely need to campaign in all 50 states, seeking votes from all across the country. That's not the case now, and it's a real problem.
Is there not an argument, though, that under that system, candidates would be more likely to campaign in high population density areas, like cities and populous states, and therefore they might actually end up abandoning a lot of the states that would be deemed less important?
So, 2 points to that. One is that under the current system, low population areas are overwhelmingly ignored, just as most of the country is overwhelmingly ignored. So the majority of very small states are safe states right now. There's only a very small number, like New Hampshire, for example, is an odd one out, a small state that happens to be a swing state. So most rural voters are totally ignored right now. The other thing is that when every vote is equal, you do need votes from rural and low population areas. You can't safely ignore them. And we see that in the election of our governors in the various states. So, for example, when you're campaigning for governor in California, we never see a governor campaign only in Los Angeles and San Francisco and the other large cities. That candidate would lose. And in fact, candidates have won governor of California while losing the biggest cities, Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example. So candidates would campaign in rural areas, and they would certainly campaign in rural areas more than they do now.
Drew Penrose, legal director at Fair Vote, speaking to World in Focus earlier this week. And you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. The flow of refugees and asylum seekers into Europe will likely slow as the winter months roll in, but governments across Europe are still struggling to build the infrastructures required to resettle those who have made the journey to Europe over the summer. Concerns have been raised over the conditions of refugee camps as thousands living in tented villages fear the impact the winter's cold weather could have.
Earlier this week, Human Rights Watch highlighted the plight of refugees in Greece, who are now regularly waking up with tents filled with rainwater, a predicament which Human Rights Watch researchers have said, quote, reflects Europe's utter failure to respond collectively and compassionately to people seeking protection. French authorities are still struggling to process and resettle hundreds of refugees following the closure of the Calais camp, known as the Jungle, in October.
This week sees the opening of Paris's first humanitarian camp in a disused hangar in the north of the city. Inside the hangar, authorities have built what they call 8 villages, each of which will house around 50 people in 4-bed dorms. But the total capacity of the camp is only 400 and is expected to receive around 80 new arrivals per day, which is far less than the number of people who have been sleeping rough in makeshift camps across Paris over the last 2 years.
It is hoped that after 10 days, which is the maximum stay for any individual, refugees and asylum seekers will then be moved to specific accommodation designated for asylum seekers. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. And finally, could cow be the world's next nation?
I know you've been looking forward to this story, but Callum, what on earth are you talking about?
Cow is a new movement, well, quite a new movement, which come from the trending Collexit hashtag.
I haven't read this at all, but this is getting me nowhere nearer to understanding what cow is.
No, on the basis that California, Oregon and Washington, which have the initials COW, see what they did there? Well, those states all voted for Hillary Clinton and they're not very pleased with the results.
Is this to do with the Yes California Independence campaign?
Yeah, a little bit. The Yes California campaign has been going for a few years now.
Was it by any chance around 2014? Because I saw their logo and it did look quite familiar.
Yeah, you probably would recognise that. It's the exact same logo as the Yes Scotland campaign, which from the campaign for Scottish independence in 2014.
Be recognisable to Scots, I would imagine. That would probably be what that would be. But how has Yes California turned into cow?
Well, the campaign started tweeting the hashtag Collexit, and this seemed to make some in Oregon and Washington a little bit jealous that California might be able to secede and become its own nation. So they suggested that all three states could join together and either become a Canadian province or an independent country.
Called Cow,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, I think this is a bit of a joke name for the nation, but there was quite a lot of jokes going around last night and this morning on Twitter around the future of cow, but they are also three states, which have legalised cannabis.
Maybe that's why they decided to call their country cow.
Maybe it is indeed. Who knows? But it is an interesting question, though.
That is unfortunately all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. You'll be sad to hear. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is, of course, Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. And in just a moment, we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And from me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.